Forget about Proposition 8. This is Preparation H, broadcasting from Gitmo Nation East in the United Kingdom. I'm Adam Curry.
And I'm John C. Dvorak up here in northern Silicon Valley.
Hey, John, how you doing?
Okay.
How was your Thanksgiving?
It was good.
Yeah, what'd you do?
Well, we had the unfortunately we're going to have Thanksgiving next weekend because I couldn't get up to Washington, so we had separate Thanksgivings because of the price of the airline tickets. And meanwhile, all the news coverage was, oh, nobody went anywhere. Nobody went. The airports were empty, and they were. There was like nobody traveling, and they were moaning and blaming it on the economy. I'll tell you what to blame it on: $500 airline fares that were normally $65. That's what to blame it on. These guys are idiots.
Oh, I love it when you're like that. Hey, so wait a minute. So did you celebrate by yourself in the Bay Area and the family was up in Seattle?
Yeah, basically.
Oh, did you have no one to celebrate with?
No, actually, one of the guys that we were sponsoring in law school, who my wife calls our fourth son, had just moved down here, and so I brought him over and fed him.
Did you make turkey?
No, I had pheasant.
Oh, that's sad, John. That's a real bummer when you can't hang out with
the pheasant.
Your family
was great.
I'm sure. Except from the pheasant's perspective.
No, it actually forced my wife to have to do the whole meal. You know, I had to walk her through a couple of things, but for the most part, she did it. She nailed it. She finally discovered that if you use a thermometer on a turkey, you can probably get the temperature right and cook perfectly.
Oh, I like those pop-up warning buttons.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So one of the things that was floating around here, though, which I go to the store to get the pheasant. I figure it's the economic collapse. I might as well have pheasant. And what to make it even more decadent?
Cake.
Truffles.
Ooh, nice. Yeah.
So there's a bunch of off-season truffles that came in, and they were dirt cheap. I mean, and they were good, solid black ones. And the woman that brought them in over at the store, local store, they came from Honduras. Now, they've had truffles. Obviously, the best truffles come from France and Italy, but then there's a lot of them coming in from Oregon. But the Oregon ones are kind of mushy, and you have to deal with them in all kinds of weird ways to make them acceptable. These are just like a French truffle. And they
What is the truffle market, or what was it before the economic malaise? Because these things were quite expensive, and they're basically, what is it? It's like a root that's under the earth that has to be uncovered by either a pig or a dog. Is that the basic idea?
It's like a fungus, and so
it's a fungus. That's right. Yeah.
It's a ball. It's a little ball, and it looks very distinctive looking. And they get to any number of sizes. I remember going to Alan Ducasse's restaurant in New York once when it was Truffle Week, and they brought out these truffles in a big box. And they opened they went to each table individually, and they opened the box and showed you these three truffles that I swear. Each one of them, they were white truffles from Italy. Each one of them was the size of a softball.
What do they cost? What do they cost?
Those probably cost about $5,000 a piece.
My goodness. But
for
a fungus.
Yeah, it's a fungus. It's very aromatic.
Yeah, but
and
still $5,000.
Very dense. Well, no, those are the big softball ones. You don't see those. I've never seen truffles like that in my life.
Why are they so expensive? Is that just because of are they scarce? Is it rarity, or what is it?
Yeah, they're hard to find, and they're, you know, they only grow under certain oak trees, and once you dig one up, you can't, you know, they don't propagate. It's not like cork, you know, you can just harvest.
We learned so much on this show, from cork to truffles.
So the... No, I mean, typically a little truffle the size, if you got one the size of a golf ball, which would be a big truffle, you know, these other ones that I was talking about at this restaurant were ludicrous. But if you got one the size of a golf ball, which would be a big truffle, you'd probably pay about, I'm guessing, around $150 for it, something like that.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot.
Now, these were small. They were the size of, they were small. I mean, they were bigger than I would expect for the price. And you got two of them
They're more like testicle size, is what I'm guessing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, it depends on, you know, if you got, but anyway. So they were like $9.
Wow, that's nothing.
So I bought a bunch of them because I said, geez, this is like ridiculous. I mean, I've never seen this price before. Even the ones from Oregon cost more than that. And so I guess somebody found some truffles in Honduras. And some oak trees, and here we go.
And do you think there's a flavor difference between the $5,000 softball truffle and the $9 Honduras testicle-sized truffle?
Yeah, yeah, the $5,000 one is better,
much better. Yeah,
I mean, you
can we grow these? I mean, is that that sounds like a fantastic business?
Impossible to grow. So anyway, that when this place, let's imagine one of the bigger restaurants that we've been to, let's take the Ritz Carlton in San Francisco and put yourself in one corner of the restaurant and then go to the complete opposite corner. Mm-hmm. When I was at Alan Ducasse's and they had this box of truffles, I was that far away when the guy at some other table that far away opened the box
and I could smell them
from there.
Wow.
It was unbelievable.
Wow, fantastic.
Anyway, so I've been having truffled eggs in the morning and truffled, basically putting truffles in the salad. I mean, you name it.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I got some hemp seeds and I've been putting them in my salads. Have you ever tried that? Hemp seeds?
Do you fry them?
You can, but you can also
Aren't they kind of hard?
No. They're actually, you can eat them right out of the container, in fact. And they're very nutty tasting and actually not that hard at all. It crunches away like you have a nice mouthful of nuts. And it's tasty and it's also filling. And the reason, of course, why I eat is because I believe it's healthy.
You believe a lot of stuff.
Yeah, sure. I'm kooky, John. Yeah, but I still look good for 44. Okay. And you can just sprinkle it on a salad, or I put it in yogurt sometimes. I eat it quite regularly.
Huh? Where do you get them?
You buy it in the supermarket, right at Sainsbury's.
Hemp seeds?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, can you plant them?
No. Well, they're deshelled, so, or whatever it is. I should go get it's three flights down. Otherwise, I go grab the container and read it off to you. But it does state specifically guaranteed not to contain any, was it TCH?
Yeah. THC.
THC. What is that?
Tetrahydrocannabinol or something like that.
Yeah. Tetrahydrocannabinol. Whatever. The good stuff, as we call it here. So it doesn't contain any of that.
Well, that must be some trendy thing. That would be fun to do. I'd play with it.
You should try it because I think you will like the taste of it. And I don't think it's a trendy. Well, maybe it is a trendy thing.
They don't sell those seeds here. If there's no THC or anything else, they're so against, even suggesting. I mean, they don't even like hemp clothing. I mean,
or rope,
they're just like freaky.
Yeah, or paper, which of course it's great for making paper.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of uses. I mean, hemp, the stuff that's low, it really has low THC content, but it's just this stringy stuff. You know, ropes used to be made out of it. It's a very valuable crop, but, they won't grow it because it's like, it's just propaganda. Talking about propaganda.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Gee, you think, wait a minute, let me just pick up the newspaper. Yes?
So there was a thing on PBS. This is one of the things I actually made a note on this because I was watching the show and it just struck me as just odd. There's a special on, and this was part two. It's the history of late night television. The show?
You recorded this, right?
I'll make a copy for you. Yes, it's actually quite entertaining because it's all about Steve Allen and then how Jack Parr came into the scene and how Johnny Carson got the job and all this kind of thing and how Merv Griffin discovered himself and that kind of thing.
Oh, excellent.
So they're showing the Steve Allen show because Steve Allen is the progenitor of all these shows. Right. And I remember watching Steve Allen when I was a kid, and I actually got to watch this show, but having also experienced the entire history of late night television, because even when I was a little kid, my dad, who was a fanatic about watching comedies, I could stay up until midnight. It wasn't a big deal. And so so I saw all these shows.
There's proof, parents. That's what happens when you let your kids stay up until any time of the night. This is what they turn into.
Right, chatterboxes on podcasts.
Big winners in society.
Anyway, so they're showing the Steve Allen thing. And one of the things I remember distinctly about Steve Allen, he had this thing called Man on the Street. And he's the one who developed it. It was he'd have some question. He'd ask these people. And they wasn't a real reality TV thing. He had these stooges, these regulars that were on the show. It was Tom Poston, who always played kind of a forgetful character. And then he had the guy who played Barney Fife, Don Knotts, who would play this nervous wreck. And he would just be shaking like a leaf when the camera was on him. Answering questions.
And that was funny back in the day. That was considered humorous.
It actually still funny.
Oh, really?
Because he was so good at it. I mean, he would just tremble head to toe in a very unbelievable way. And then he had Louis Nye, who always played some slickster who was a New Yorker or something. And then the last guy he had was Bill Dana. And Bill Dana would come on, and he would play this Mexican character named Jose Jimenez. And Steve would always the gag always began with Steve Allen asking Jose Jimenez, what's your name? And the guy would say, "My name, Jose Jimenez," and with this "my name."
Like you could make those kind of jokes today in our PC world, huh?
Well, even during this era, which was some time ago. Some anti-defamation group found it very offensive to have Bill Dana saying "my name." Even though, if you go see the movie Scarface, with Brian De Palma.
Say hello to my little friend, motherfucker.
So they somehow, even though this was after he became a stand-up comic doing this character, and they hounded him out of business, and I think he basically lost his living, and that was the end of it. So I'm watching the special, and they, to me, left him out of the story completely. Trying to, it was just obviously suppressed. I mean, even though this is years and years ago, and this is a historic document now, this is 50
years.
Well,
now, hold on a second. Hold on a second. Obviously suppressed, please. I mean, people who make television shows and documentaries are often just, they have an opinion, they're just boneheads, and the zeitgeist is people don't remember this shit.
The problem is that they showed the other characters in this.
So they had to make it within 60 minutes, and they had to cut one out. They had to make a choice.
There's plenty of crap in there that could have been cut out. Left him out.
I'm debunking John C. Dvorak. What has the world become to?
And I'm reminded, it reminds me of what, Bill Cosby's been trying to do for the last 5 or 6 years, which is scoop up every possible copy he can find of Amos and Andy.
That's right. Because he wants all the rights and he wants to reissue and do that again, or what does he want to do?
No, he wants to destroy it. He thinks it should not be, even viewed by anyone.
You'd think that it would be much funnier if he actually turned it around, if he used that in a different way. But it's nuts to even in this day of digital media to even think you can do that. Let me go to YouTube.
Can't be done.
No, of course not.
But anyway, that's the thing. But I noticed the missing Bill Dana was the name of the character. I mean, the name of the actor, Bill Dana, the comic. It was just left out. I mean, because I swear to God, they had everybody else that was ever on that show mentioned or something. And the Jose Jimenez character was important to the Man on the Street sketch. Anyway, I just found it galling.
Almost as galling as the airlines, huh?
No, the airlines. And they wonder why they, have trouble making money.
I have a sound effect for us today, John.
Oh.
You ready? You ready?
Sure.
There it goes. You know what this is?
It sounds like the subway or a train or something like that.
No, listen again. You got to listen really carefully to it. That is the sound of the printing press at the Federal Reserve, John.
It's going at full speed.
Yeah, you better believe it is. Oh man. It's been so fantastic to see all this stuff being created and printed and thrown away, and there's so much happening that it you can't even track it all anymore. We're now at $7.4 trillion that has been pumped in the past 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, all the good it's done me.
and I love it that the Fed still won't tell anyone what they've given this money to or what they've received in exchange for it. And oh man, Obama's financial team Summers, Geithner, Volker.
Yeah, the same guys.
Yeah, dude, a lot of change.
Change,
this is
hope.
Change, yeah. Change. Robert Gates, defense secretary, left in place. There's some change for you.
But I got the biggest kick, and you haven't been over here, but they've been debating this Robert Gates thing since the idea first came up, and it's just the weirdest thing to listen to everybody and their sister from both sides of the aisle go on and on about how it would be really cool for Robert Gates to stay. There wasn't one person that says this idea sucks. Get
You're
rid
kidding
of it.
Me.
No, everybody, both the Democrats and the Republicans and the conservatives and the most extreme liberals all thought Robert Gates was the guy, the go-to guy. It would show the magnanimous, you know, bipartisanship, you know, of the nature.
I'm putting Republicans in my cabinet. I'm doing the right thing. Oh, man.
So I don't know.
Well,
I guess.
Well, I think I got it figured out, John. You want one? I mean, you just went off on your little conspiracy theory there about
Bill Dana and Jose Dana. Jimenez.
Yeah. So, of course, we've all been at least following to some degree the attacks in, I still have to call it Bombay, but okay, call it Mumbai if you want. And there's a lot of things that is really bugging me about the reporting on this. First of all, the immediacy. They haven't even captured any guys. I think they say they killed a couple, but, you know, we have one picture of a guy wearing a Versace sweatshirt. And now we, of course, immediately know that they are Islamic, radical Islamic terrorists. And I started to put all these things together. You know, Obama saying, hey, I'm going to pull all the troops out of Iraq. Of course, that means I'm going to send them to Afghanistan. So sending them to Afghanistan. And then I'm thinking, all right, so obviously, you know, what they're doing now, if you listen to the Prime Minister of India, he's saying, oh, no, this is Pakistan. This is Pakistan who's doing it, and now the move is towards Pakistan. And if you look at the map, which you might want to do, I know you do, John, but I'm just saying it to our listeners, from time to time, just pull up Google Earth there and go look at Pakistan, and you'll see that on one side it borders on Afghanistan, and on the other side it borders on Iran. So if we got, or Afghanistan borders on both of those. So now I've got all these guys in Afghanistan, right on the border, in fact, with Pakistan. I think that there's a poise here to take over Pakistan, which already politically, of course, is severely weakened. It's a nuclear country. We're building up troops right on the border. I'm thinking that this is, and by the way, there have been, in the past, you know, like 7 years, there's been an attack in India every 6 months with 60 or 80 people being killed. And this just stinks to me completely. I think, it's a gear up for some kind of assault on Pakistan.
Well, that's not bad. It's not like your usual material.
Well, of course, the usual material part would be that these obviously are hired mercenaries who are trained. That has nothing to do with terrorism, because since when does Al-Qaeda all of a sudden take hostages and use AK-47s? It's completely different from any type of Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist attack. These guys look pretty damn professional to me. And it looks like they were hired. They went in. They just were in there to kill. And it doesn't seem to me like, you know.
I think that's reasonable too. What I meant when I said it's not like a usual thing, I thought that you were going to summarize.
Oh, by saying the CIA
that the
did this?
Are somehow behind this thing. And
no, the CIA. You've got to believe that we are behind it. Israel's behind it. Yeah. You know, there's a big thing. Oh, now there's a Jewish house of worship or whatever that they're calling it. They're not calling it a synagogue, they're calling it something else. This one, here's something that really bugged the hell out of me. Because, you know, there's, well, first of all, they're saying, oh, it seems like they were targeting Americans and Britons. Although, you know, like, of the 130 people who've been killed, only a few were actually American or British. But there's this one guy, a multimillionaire, Andreas Liveras. And he was on the phone with the BBC. And right after that, he got killed. And so I'm like, wow, that's fascinating. So I'm looking around for the, for an audio or something like that. I don't know if he actually was on air, but I found a short transcript on the BBC website, and here's what he said. This was interesting. So he was in the restaurant, about 1,000 people in the restaurant, and hold on a second, where is it? He said that they were locked in. He said, there must be more than 1,000 people here. There are residents and tourists and locals. We are not hiding. We are locked in here. The doors are locked and we are inside. Now, you know, what kind of terrorist goes through, you know, all of this, you know, locking people in a room, containing them. They cut the television services so no one could have, you know, they cut the telephone, connections to the outside. You know, this is a major ass attack, John. I mean, this is a coordinary military effort. This doesn't seem like a bunch of bozos. And boy, do you think they were armed? I mean, this is to me, this is very, very troubling.
Well, somebody else on Fox or someplace else pointed out that it was a very low tech thing, because it was just basically armed men, militia types, that, you know, just took over all these places, that burned, you know, the hotels and did all the rest of it. But you might be onto something here, because it doesn't, because all the things that Al Qaeda's ever done is they'll do a coordinated thing, but they bomb the crap out of everything.
Suicide bomb, yeah. And the most people who were killed, and we're just talking about it really easily, it's horrible, of course, but the most people who were killed were in the train station, which were mainly Indians. You know, so there's a definite spin being put out there, and that's the shit you got to watch for. There's a real spin on that. A, it was links to Al Qaeda or now they had some Mujahideen group, which is, you know, by even the definition of Mujahideen is not really something you can pinpoint.
Right. Well, they also mentioned that this is the Dakar Mujahideen, which is from an area.
An area.
And they
region,
say it's somehow related to this other one. Really, because I listened to the analysis on Fox, and it was a stretch. It was like, well, you know, first of all, they said we don't even know who these people are at the beginning. Remember when this thing first broke? It was like everyone was baffled by who these people were. Yeah. And then they announced who they were, and everyone said, "Who are they? We never heard of them."
Yeah.
Which, of course, then is a bad reflection on the Indian. A lot of people are reflecting negative.
Well, did you hear the audio of the Dekka Mujahideen? They called in to Sky News or whatever, like, yeah, and they were speaking in Indian, and so there was translation, but it was like, yes, we are the Dekka Mujahideen, we are responsible. And then the reporter says, what are your demands? And the guy goes like, hold up, demands. Hey, like he didn't know what the demands were. He had to ask some guy. So it's, you know, it's clearly either fake or, you know, set up, or it's just not right. It's crap.
Yeah, you know, I'm not gonna until the reporting is finished. We're reporting. I guess I'm in the dream world.
Reporting.
Let me take some more drugs.
Yeah.
what reporting,
John? Oh, all right, excellent.
So it's like, what reporting? I mean, there's going to be no reporting, so we're never going to find out is what I'm trying to get at here, obviously, because if it's what you think it might be, which is a phony baloney deal. And by the way, it's interesting that it coincides with the IMF.
Oh, I was looking for something. Tell me about the IMF.
They've done a deal with Pakistan.
Oh, this makes so much sense. So we hit him twice. We hit him in the financial nuts, and we just take everything and everybody out and move in. Yeah. Now listen to this, dude. Major massive Gitmo Nation news. You will love this in the United Kingdom. So we have a shadow government here. So we have the people running the country, and then right on the other side of the House of Commons, you've got what they call the shadow government. So you, for the there's an immigration minister in parliament, and then there's the that would be a Labour immigration minister, and then on the other side you have the shadow immigration minister. In this case, it's Minister Green, and so over the past couple months, a number of stories, really whistleblower stories, have broken in the newspapers in the UK. One was that we talked about this, that there were, thousands of illegal immigrants who had been cleared to work in sensitive jobs in the government, and that the Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, knew this months before it ever came out. There was another one about an illegal Brazilian immigrant who was working as a cleaner in Parliament. Let's see. There was what people would think about the 42-day incarceration. There were a number of stories that were getting leaked to the press, which I consider to be, you know, hey, look, it's the government. We deserve to know about this stuff. So what they did is they had suspicion that it was the Conservatory Minister Green, Damian Green of Immigration, who was leaking this to the press. They took him out of his house last night, arrested him, took him to, interrogated him for 9 hours while they searched his homes both in London and in Kent. I mean, dude, does this remind you of anything?
It's great.
This is outrageous. It's absolutely outrageous.
I wonder if they slapped him around a little bit, just to, you know, with the organ.
I hope so. That makes the story so much better.
Inner tube, you know, or something where they do it.
Waterboarded him. I mean, that is just outrageous that this is taking place. Let me tell you another one, because you'll get a kick out of this. The British man. I love the Brits. And I've been talking to him about this. You know, they said, why are you on your back like bitches, letting the government piss on you all the time? And, which, by the way, they have a term here, which is called, bohica.
Oh, yeah. Bend over, here it comes.
Here it comes again. Yeah.
Here it comes again.
Yeah. So they had this big blow up about these two talk show hosts, Russell Brand and Jonathan Ross. We talked about that. And, you know, these guys make a lot of money, and they said, like, you know, they fucked someone's granddaughter and was a big brouhaha, and should they be fired? And one resigned and the other was, kicked off the air for 3 months. But they have Dancing with the Stars, which of course originated here in the United Kingdom, which is called, Strictly Come Dancing in the official pronunciation. And, there was a guy on, actor, singer, comedian, one of those, older gentleman named John Sargent. And the guy can't dance, but the audience loves the guy.
When I went through Europe last week, I was reading all these papers and, you know, because there's all the British papers. And I was reading, though, there was like a big deal about John Sargent, and they had pictures of him.
Right.
And there were editorials all over the place about how he can't dance. And I'm reading, what is wrong with these people?
Well, so this is what's amazing from a number of perspectives. So the judges were, you know, scale of 1 to 10, the judges kept giving him 1, 2, you know, 3. I mean, completely failing scores. But the audience, who ultimately decides who stays on, kept voting for him because they loved it. They were like, this is entertaining. It was funny to watch him. And it really was funny because, you know, you dance with a real professional and she's basically doing all the moves and he's like dragging her across the floor. It was funny. It really worked. And then, you know, it was like this big, oh, well, you know, this can't be, this is a dancing competition, and then John Sargent said, oh, well, you know what, I'm just gonna resign the show. And I'm thinking, so the British public, who's so outraged about paying for these two comedians who just weren't funny for once, and they're so outraged, where this is a blatant setup, where they kick the guy off the show, someone's lying somewhere, and they're just letting it go. You know, it's like, I don't get it. And like, oh, okay, well, I guess that makes sense. And, you know, and Patricia has this fight on Pop Stars in Holland all the time. You know, because it's like, well, this girl, you know, this is one contestant who's really rocking, right? She's above average singer, but she weighs about 230 pounds, and she wears dumb dresses to go with it, which are not flattering. And the audience loves her because, of course, losers always win on these shows. And they're like, well, we gotta, you know, her other judge is like, we gotta get her off the show. This is ridiculous. You know, this is a serious competition. How can she ever become a pop star? And Patricia's like, F you. The people love her. What do you want? Do you want? And she literally said to the other judges, do you like that new house you bought? Then you better keep this bitch on the show. Is that the audience wants it. That's what keeps the ratings going. And I'm just amazed by the British public taking that lying down.
Unbelievable. Well, there was sure a lot of articles about it. And I actually should have asked you about it the last time we spoke, because I was unaware of the backstory. I just noticed it was like a whole bunch of attention. It was getting a lot of attention.
It didn't really hit me until I started thinking about it. And I'm like, this is crazy. This is just absolutely nuts.
Well, I don't see things getting any better, and I'm surprised we don't have more of that kind of thing going on here. As much as there's a fascist state a brewing everywhere in the U.S., the Brits have got us beat hands down. If there was a competition on what state has just gone completely fascist.
Let me give it to you, man. So Patricia called me. She was traveling to Holland today, and she takes EasyJet. She loves EasyJet. She'll take EasyJet over British Airways, KLM, anything. She thinks system's great, and I agree with her. Huh. And so she calls me and says, "I'm finally at the gate." I said, "What happened?" She said, "Well, you won't believe it." Now, John, you've never met my wife. Have you ever seen a picture of her?
Oh, yeah. You have a picture on your phone, and I've seen pictures of her because I've seen her in action on that show because you sent a link to it.
Yeah, okay. So she's beautiful. And do you think she looks like a potential terrorist, John? just an offhand question. Do you think that she looks like a potential terrorist? No, obviously not. So she rolls up to the X-ray machine, and she's already, because the show is this evening, so she's already kind of pre-prepped, and she's looking good, and she's she already has stuff on that she's going to wear on the show, and she has a small tube of toothpaste and a miniature travel size bottle of Chanel. That's my wife, Miss Chanel. And so it goes to the X-ray machine, and they say, stop, okay. And they say, "Look, ma'am, this is not in a plastic bag." And by the way, Patricia always laughs at them, which, she just smiles and is always happy, which makes them crazy. And, I mean, I would be calling you from jail today if this happened to me. So she says, oh, really? Well, do you have a plastic bag? And they're like, no, you got to go all the way back. So it's like a 20-minute line, right? She said, okay. So she went all the way back outside. She had to get a plastic baggie, put her toothpaste and the Chanel in it, then wait in line 20 minutes to go all the way back through. And then this is the kicker. So they, of course, it's the same people, and they recognize her, and they say, okay, it's in the bag. And they say, we have to do a liquid test.
What?
They literally tested the Chanel and the toothpaste. They tested it, which consisted of spraying the Chanel number 5 into the air and sniffing it.
Unbelievable. Maybe one of the people there wanted a dose of Chanel number 5, so they could go on a date later.
This is the danger in a fascist state, where you have people who have a uniform. And they have a certain amount of authority for a microsecond of your lifetime. And, if they're having a bad day or whatever it is, they take advantage of it. And clearly this is ridiculous and harassment. I mean, there's no doubt this is just bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. Unquestionably. Yep. Well, was this leaving? Was this going into the airport in London, or what?
It was at Gatwick. This afternoon.
Liquid test.
It's nuts, and it's just getting worse.
Well, I mean, there's going to be something's bad's going to happen.
Oh, okay. What do you think? I got a couple of ideas. What do you think?
I think the British public's, they're going to, at some point, I mean, the British there is a mean streak in that culture that is going to come out, and I think it's going to...
Well, this is what I'm waiting for. I want that thin, wiry, white English bloke on the street burning shit and waving sticks. That's what I always thought the Brits were like.
Well, that movie Vendetta. Did you see V for Vendetta?
Oh, yeah, I love that. Of course. Remember the 5th of November gunpowder treason and plot. Oh, yeah, I love it. You bet I love it. Guy Fawkes. Yeah, sure.
Well, I'm expecting something like that and just blow up Parliament. I mean, that's what Guy Fawkes tried to do.
And it's funny that they still celebrate him, and they do that by creating a bonfire and getting hammered.
Well, that's all they celebrate everything by getting hammered.
Oh, excellent news for you, by the way. Good buddy of mine, in fact, a very good friend of mine, we stayed at his house in the south of France this summer. He owns one of the largest nightclubs, complexes, I should say, in Surrey. And he has a strip joint called the Lion's Den, which I'd never been to. I've been to his clubs several times, and we had Christina's birthday party at one of his clubs. And he said, look, man, I'm up for the license for all the Playboy clubs in the United Kingdom, which don't exist yet. And so, you know, I'm like, well, that's cool. He said, I'm trying to get a cool crowd together because these guys are coming by and they're going to come check the place out. So I'm like, yeah, sure. I'll come in. I'll look jet settery and I'll talk up a storm and no problem. So I go over there last night at 10 o'clock after I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, which I also should mention a couple things about in a moment. And so the place is there, you know, I was like, yeah, everyone's hanging out, and it's not really crazy busy, but it's perfect for the setting to impress these guys who are coming in. And Michelle says, here, man, you know, have a lap dance on me with one of his top performers. And I'm like, okay, you know, because I'll go to the VIP area. Something I did not know, John, in the United Kingdom at lap dancing clubs, they take their panties off as well. And, and you get a full-blown show.
That's interesting.
I went, oh my. I was like, oh my.
Now, are you sure this wasn't just for you?
No, because there were other guys in the VIP area and the same thing was going on. Cause actually when I walked in, There was a girl I could see just from behind. I could see either that's an invisible G-string or she doesn't have one on, but I didn't think much of it.
Hmm.
And the show was very, like, it was a coordinated show because I saw these girls do the exact same show. So it wasn't like a personalized anything. And it's not like, you know, you're up close, but you ain't that close. But still, oh my.
Huh.
Yeah. So when you coming back?
I don't know, but we got to visit that place.
Oh, you'll love Michelle. Oh, you'll love him. He's we're flying tomorrow to I'm taking him to see Patricia perform. She's doing a big benefit concert for starving children, and she's going to perform three songs with a 65-piece orchestra. Her dad is accompanying her on violin. Her 84-year-old dad. Mm. She's doing a Smile, I think, with him on violin. So that should be cool. But yeah, you'll like Michelle when you're over here next.
So that's why people should know we're doing the show on Friday.
Well, I was not planning on telling anybody, honestly.
Well, I think they should know because, you know, I think it's full disclosure.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point.
So in case there's something happens, why are these guys, they missed that whole story?
Well, should we upload it today then or on Saturday?
I don't think we have a problem uploading it today. I'm not a big, you know, I mean, this is the great thing about
not being in the fake corporate media.
Yeah. Yeah, we can do what we want.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can be off a day or skip a week. I mean, the fact of the matter is, especially if people are doing this right, the people that listen to this thing religiously. And by the way, anyone out there who listens to us,
tell a friend.
Get a friend so we can get our numbers up to some point that we can theoretically pay for this thing. But anyway,
get a couple lap dances out of it.
Better than poking an eye with a sharp stick.
it was pretty similar, actually, John.
So people who do it right would obviously have an RSS feed that they would get this thing downloaded to their iPod automatically,
right.
and be surprised.
Yeah.
Whoa,
and then,
look.
Oh, whoa. Gee, that was a concept.
Yeah.
But speaking of that, I was just watching CNBC. Money Honey Aaron was on. I thought she might be off for the long Thanksgiving weekend, and they had a report on radio stocks, and except for CBS Radio, which currently sits around $6, all these other companies, MS, the 15% of Clear Channel that is actually still public, Sirius, every single one of them is under $1 a share. Some of them 18 or 19 cents a share. Radio is effectively dead.
Sirius is really amazing.
Well, it's not. They're losing $750 million.
Yeah, I know, and there's no way they're ever going to turn this around. I had predicted this, by the way, when they first formed years and years and years ago.
How hard is that?
But I sure got a bunch of flack. Oh, that can't be true. But meanwhile, I had more people say to me, in fact, that was with somebody the other day, and says, you know, and the guy could afford it. He drives around a Bentley, and he says, you know, I just gave up on my Sirius and XM radio subscriptions to the Bentley. I just listened to podcasts.
Exactly.
Because he's got, you know, apparently the Bentley Continental has a clip in it.
It has a connector. Yeah, it has a
connector that you can hook your iPod right to it. And,
The whole problem, well, first of all, these companies were built with dot-com money. That's when they got their first infusion of cash. And, they have some beautiful facilities, just unbelievable.
Oh, yeah, I've seen pictures of the, I guess, XM or Sirius. They're fantastic.
And they got, in New York, Sirius has 55 studios.
Yeah.
And that's excluding the palace Howard Stern has right in the middle of reception there. But of course, they wanted to merge these two companies, and then the FCC and whoever else and the SEC, they really let it linger and linger and linger, and they wouldn't give a decision. So the stocks just kind of steadily declined. And now, of course, their main source of distribution is not actually satellite. Their main source of distribution is vehicles. And so what these guys do, it's not Norm Pattison. Who's running it?
I don't know.
Oh, whatever. Guy from CBS, I think. Anyway, their main gig is to get the big automakers to pre-install Sirius and XM satellite receivers in their vehicles. And
Like they did in the 90s, everyone was talked into installing AM.
Do you remember stereo? Yeah, I remember that. Stereo AM.
So I have one of those radios where it says, and when you get it, AM stereo. By the way, there's nobody broadcasts an AM stereo anymore. But we used to turn the dial and you would find the one station on the entire spectrum that had an AM. So it would light up. A little thing would light up on the radio, say AM stereo.
Stereo!
So you'd listen to it, and it was the crappiest, I don't know even what the point of it was. It didn't sound any better. It didn't even hold a candle or come close to what FM sounds like. So what was the point?
I'm trying to think. There was a reason. There were a couple of different reasons they were trying to
implement. Yeah, I remember
that.
At some CES, somebody gave me some rationale about AM stereo and how it's going to actually take over because you get bigger distances, it's better than FM and all the rest of it, and it didn't go anywhere. It's like this thing that's going on, this high-definition radio that's going on right now. They're trying to push HD radio, and that's not going anywhere. I mean, it's just like, this stuff is fixed already. It's done. It's over. You got your AM. You got what you got. You got talk radio. It's what it's turned into. And then you have your FM, which is you got your music and you got whatever else you want to put over there in the public radio.
And then you've got the real media, the real true new media podcast.
Yeah. And then you have the new media, which are, much more versatile. You can listen anytime you want. You're not stuck. I'm still irked about it. A lot of us listen to right wing talk radio because it's very entertaining. And every once in a while, the guy will say something or somebody will say something and you want to back it up or you wanted to save it, or you can't do any of that. And you can't listen to it when you want to listen to it. You have to listen to it when they're broadcasting. And I mean, the whole thing is, that whole model of, time based broadcasting is it
old
if
fashioned.
You have a choice, nobody would prefer it. You prefer the more versatile style, which is what we're doing.
Hell yeah.
One of these days, advertisers will get a clue and they'll start realizing
that's not entirely true, because our audio programming is doing millions of dollars a month, of which a significant portion goes to the producers of those audio programs with our transactional campaigns. You know this. You've been in these meetings. This shit works. You use my code for GoDaddy. You use my code for eHarmony. Use my code for Budget. Use my code for Foot Locker. And I think that as we move into the depression, that as long as the grid stays up and people can still connect, I think that we'll see increasing use of these types of offerings. And that's it for us. It's 40% of our revenue, John. It's a serious business.
No, I'm not saying it's not, but it's not. If you put it side by side with big media, it's like a spin.
Yeah, but think about it. The reason why, for the same reasons that radio in broadcast towers is no longer valid because you have to listen at that moment, the interruptive nature of advertising also doesn't work anymore. You can skip past it. You can ignore it. You can. It completely breaks the model. And which is why, the counting of downloads never worked. No one could ever agree on it. We had all kinds of guilds and organizations and societies and whatever. And it'll just never work that way. And by the way, listen to radio. They're doing the exact same thing. They're saying, hey, use my code. All of them are.
Well, I have a code, budget.com/tech.
Yeah, I've got my code is... Go ahead. No, go ahead.
10% off of any budget. And by the way, I say this on the Tech 5 thing, which is that I use budget because they really do have the coolest cars.
And you get a 10% discount on your weekly rental.
They've had Jaguars. They got all kinds of cool stuff. Anyway.
So you won't have Jaguars anytime in the future. They're about to go belly up.
Well, that's a shame.
Well, it's a massive shame because I got to get rid of my Jag and no one will buy it.
Well, the problem is, of course, you know, Jaguars have the reputation of once they get past warranty, they just start falling apart. So I don't see too many old ones on the road.
Well, this one is not that old, but the dealer will not buy it back. They don't have the money. They do, and they can't have a car that has actual money of theirs in it sitting on the lot. And they said, there's no one. Look around. There's no one here. So we're not selling any cars. No one's coming in. The people who do come in, half of them can't get the financing.
Hmm.
So the only people who are coming in are people who really have the money cash down to buy a good deal on something new. But Jaguar, now that Tata, who owns them, has said, hey, we need £1 billion to stay in business because they're looking for their own bailouts. Don't think it's just the big three. Over here, Nissan, Toyota, Bentley, Aston Martin, Jaguar, they've all asked the government for help. They're all in the same position. There's no difference between here and the United States, unless you listen to Gordon Brown, who says it's all the all America's fault.
You say Jaguar the way Stewie would on Family Guy.
Jaguar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I am Stewie. Jaguar. I slip in a couple of my correct pronunciations from time to time. I'm slowly going through my transformation.
Yeah, you're going to become British.
No, I don't think there's any danger of that. I will, however, have to register for my ID card with biometric data.
Yeah? What biometric data are they going to steal from you?
Well, of course, they don't
take a sample of your blood. That's what they should do.
Yeah, they don't actually tell you, but this is the same Jackie Smith of the Home Office, the one who said that everyone's clamoring and so excited about the national ID cards. She literally said that. Oh, I get calls. The people are so excited, they can't wait to have one. So the first group of people who are singled out, who, of course, will be the first ones to get on the train to the camp, are people like me. If you're married to an EU national, and which gives you the right to live and work in the United Kingdom, then you're the first group to get a card. It will contain your visa status, name, address, picture, fingerprint, and, quote, other biometric data, which I can only assume is probably will be DNA.
Could be. Should they take a swab?
In the Netherlands, there's a big debate going on about something called the electronic child dossier. And they want to start this in 2009. When a child was born, basically they create a new record in the database and call that the electronic child dossier, which obviously is meant for easy access to information about the child so that physicians medical institutions can swiftly access the information, and it'll probably stop terrorism as well. But what the big debate has been, so they have all these fields, you know, name, skin color, eye color, hair color, and then they have a field in the record, which is the subject of the debate, which is pubic hair. And literally there are like three choices of pubic hair that have to be entered into the record.
What?
Yes, sir. Pubic hair. How fucked up is that?
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, unbelievable.
In fact, it's so unbelievable, I don't believe it. You have to send me a link. I got to blog it.
Okay, I'll see if there's an English article about it yet, but it's all in Dutch so far. And I'm sure Google Translate won't really do it justice. But yeah, the three options were, I think, curly, Harry and Curly, or just adult Harry, or something. That's a direct translation, so it sounds kind of weird. And I was talking to Patricia about this. I said, yeah, so clearly you have this electronic child dossier well into puberty. I said, so everyone will have one. So what are you going to put on yours, honey? Do we have to change yours from time to time? It was like Brazilian landing strip. Ooh, nothing. Hubby likes it. You know,
I mean, what? Heart.
By the way, the girls at the club last night, no entry. Just leave that one blank, baby.
That's funny.
But how, I mean, this is what's going on all over Europe, John. It's like in record tempo. This stuff is just click, click, click. It's happening.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just the 1,000-year Reich.
The 1,000-year Reich? Oh, is this another cyclical thing?
No. I mean, that's what Hitler said when he began his, like, program to make everything fascist. He said there'd be a 1,000-year Reich. It'd be 1,000 years of this, you know. And then, of course, you know, they beat him in World War II, and everyone figured it was the end of it. But I guess not.
It's pretty scary.
So on other news,
yes.
What else is going on?
Hold on a second. I did a little bit of homework as he ruffles the Financial Times open.
So when I was floating around Portugal doing my show, I brought with me some gear. I brought what did I bring? All I brought was the M Audio interface.
It sounded good. It worked.
And a PR. I used that's because it was a Heil PR 42.
Wait, a 42? No. It's a 40, not a 40.
Oh, it's a 40, 42? Okay. Yeah, it's a 40.
Okay.
It's that really good Heil mic.
The one that
Leo Laporte uses, because, you know, and Leo's been in radio forever, and he used to use that. There's a one EV model that everybody in radio used to use.
Yeah, the Electro Voice,
Yeah, an Electro Voice, specific dynamic Electro Voice. Now, these aren't condenser mics, which is interesting, because this Heil sounds exactly like a condenser mic as far as I can tell.
But without the phantom power.
Without needing this extra power to drive it. It's just a regular dynamic microphone, but it sounds so good. So I got a bunch of notes from people, although I'd need to have some sort of a protector.
Wait a minute. They said, it sounds better than normal. That's what they said, right?
Yeah.
I have this happen all the time. I use my lav in New York, and people are like, wow, this sounds awesome. You should always sound like this. So now I'm actually talking on the same wireless lav mic. I don't know if it's just because it sounds different and then people think it sounds better, or if we over-obsess the sound and so that it actually sounds shittier than normal, but I've noticed this exact same thing. Whenever I change my setup on the road, people like it.
I had a guy send me a note saying, tell Adam to stay with that, because you were wearing a headset on one of the shows or something.
It's this mic. It's the mic that I'm talking through right now.
They said, tell him to just use that mic. It sounds a million times better.
Yeah, and yeah. I am.
That's why I'm going to get a country. I'm going to get a Countryman.
I got to get a Countryman too. I really want to try that.
Because this PR40, which is a nice, beautiful sounding mic. In fact, I'll probably switch to it. I'm using an AKG, but a condenser with a tube.
Sounds nice.
But apparently the other one will sound better. But the travel with that PR40, the thing is a big clunker. It's huge. And then every time I got stopped at one of the gates on the airplane.
They want to know what that is.
They'd find it, and then they'd hold it up, and they'd look around and say, what's this? You know, they don't know what a microphone is.
They do a liquid test on that fucker.
You know, I'm surprised they didn't crack it open. But anyway, So I come back from Europe with two salamis and a microphone.
Two salamis and a microphone. His name is John C. D. Ooh, y'all OG.
And so they're all obsessing. They don't give a shit about the salamis. They're obsessing over this microphone. But anyway, it's too big. Now, the Countryman is just a wire. It's just a wisp of a thing. I mean, it doesn't weigh anything. It weighs nothing. I mean, if that mic sounds as good as the PR, and my experience, it does. It sounds as good as the PR40.
Yeah, then why take the PR40?
Take
that thing
on the road, the Countryman, and just, you know, you don't, because when you travel, you know, people don't travel a lot. They don't understand.
They have no idea.
When you travel, I travel light. I know how to pack a suit into a regular suitcase that can go under a seat.
And how to roll a salami in it.
I got the salami in the computer case.
A new game. It's Hide the Salami with John C. Dvorak.
So I've got a light. So I travel very light, and I see these poor schmucks that, and especially these, some of these women, who don't know how to travel, and their husbands put up with this crap. They have a suitcase the size of like a refrigerator, and you know, and they can't move it, or and they can't put it up overhead. They can't do anything with it. The thing's way too big, and hubby is stuck. I went to the Oakland airport to go up north about two or three months ago, and it was the funniest thing. There was one of these women. She was doing her nails in the front of the bus from the parking lot thing, and when I got on this whole luggage area was stacked to the gills with luggage, and so they get off. And this woman, you know, she refuses to carry anything but her handbag. And this poor schlub husband of hers, he's got like two huge rollers and another thing. And the kids have got a couple of bags. And he's got some stuff over his head. I mean, you know, around his neck because he's holding. The poor guy's loaded down like a mule.
And did he have a baby hanging from him as well?
I don't, you know, there was just short of that. And the little girl that's with them goes up to, and she said, and I just cracked it. She goes up to her mother and says, Mommy, why does daddy have to take all the luggage all the time? You know, she's giving her crap
about
it.
Smart, yeah.
And this poor daddy, he was carrying all this thing. I mean, you can travel with one bag, but I always tell people to travel with nothing and then buy stuff over there and ship it back. But you can travel very light if you try. I know people that travel, for example, this is a rant. I know people that travel, for example, and they'll bring, before the liquid thing, which I think was a benefit to all travelers, before the 3-ounce rule, which is 100 milliliters actually, they would bring an entire giant bottle, a year's supply of shampoo, and pack it. Why would you? What are you bringing this giant bottle of shampoo on a 2-week trip or a 1-week trip or whatever? It's just ridiculous.
You should be at Heathrow. Very often the Virgin Atlantic flight from San Francisco lands simultaneously with a flight from Mumbai. My goodness, man! The Indians when they travel, it's like it's enormous the amount of luggage they have. Absolutely enormous, big crates. Huge. And you see, and of course, they're always stopped at immigrations and some schmuck there is unpacking all this care. I mean, then they pack it tight. And I don't know if they're coming over here forever or what, but it's unreal. Unreal.
Yeah, when I see this big luggage, I'm always thinking, are you moving there? Is that why you're bringing so much stuff?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I tell people, I guess there's some women. In fact, I went to, when I went to Korea, Gina Smith, she brought like 10 pairs of, or 15 pairs of shoes. And I said, what do you brought all these shoes for? She said, well, somebody told me, she hadn't been there before. She says that they really are picky about shoes. You can't wear the same pair of shoes twice. And I'm thinking, you believe this?
Aye, aye, aye. Even I wouldn't believe that one.
So anyway.
Hey, Woolworths is bankrupt over here.
I didn't even know they were still in business.
Oh, they've been in, oh yeah. Oh, Woolworths has been in business here for decades.
I don't think I've seen a Woolworths. We used to have Woolworths all over.
Well, it was
the
bought
place.
Up. It was purchased by, so Woolworths in like 1908 or 08 or something like that. I think they opened up a store in the United Kingdom. And, who's the name of the guy? I'm sure it's, John H. Woolworth. He discovered that, it was the original five and dime concept.
Right, right.
And it really worked over in the United Kingdom, particularly with an American in the store. And so he really expanded in the 1970s. You know, they had, I think they had 700-800 stores.
Huh.
And they were bought up by another big, conglomerate that owns multiple chains. But Woolworths for the UK ever since the 70s, it's really been the place where you buy your music, very much like a Walmart, I guess. So they're bankrupt, which is culturally a big deal here.
Hmm. Well, we used to have a Woolworths, nearby. At the El Cerrito Plaza. And, I would go there. You'd always could go there. You know, that style of store. There's also, there used to be a Kresge in Berkeley or a Kress or whatever it was. I think it was Kresge, which was a deep competitor, which had the cooler stores because they had the big round glass windows and all this other stuff. Yeah, anyway, you could go there. You could always, there was just about everything you wanted. you know, if you needed glue or scotch tape or, you know, something, you actually, it's all like, it was like a miniaturized what Target sells.
Like, do you remember Zehrs?
I vaguely remember Zehrs. I think it was like a chain on the East Coast.
Yeah, it was East Coast, because I remember when we'd go on vacation in the 70s, back from Europe to the States, we'd always be excited because we'd stay at in Armonk at my grandparents' place, and in White Plains they had a huge Zehrs, and we'd go to Zehrs and we'd just shop. You know, it was one of the first everything there for everybody. Lose your kids for 5 hours.
Hmm. Yeah, well, now the big box stores have taken over that business. I mean, Target is the one that fascinates me the most because I'm still reminded of the White Front stores that used to be here, which were actually a mob, a guy who was on witness protection. And okay. And there's always these, they always have these names. I think Conway Trucking was one of these things. There's always some joke.
Yeah, the name game. Sure.
In the name. And Target has always been to me one of those joke names. It's Target of what? You know, it's like a Target. And so I'm thinking, you know, and I keep going to these, and they got so many Targets. If you drive up Highway 80, there's a Target store about once every 2 miles off the freeway, and very high. These are high expensive real estate areas, and so there's a Target that I can see one from my house, and then you go up. There's another one up in Richmond. There's another one further up, and then there's another and another and another. There's all these Target stores. There's a whole slew of them. And you go into these stores, and they're great stores, by the way, even though everything's from China, but they have everything, and you can get anything there. They even have food now, and you can get soap, and you can get dog food, and you can get, you know, tissue, and you can get scotch tape. It's just like a Woolworths, only they're huge. And you can get out of a Target store almost instantly. They have way too many checkers. I mean, you never wait. You go in, no matter when it is, and you rarely wait behind one person. There's always an open thing. Just you're out of there. It's amazing. It's a great store. But I don't see how they can afford to stay in business, because I don't see that the traffic is that outrageous going in and out of there.
Well, I don't know.
But because of places like Target, there's no more five and dime stores.
Well, I do know that we're trying to do business with them. I know that they're interested in working with us.
Well, they do a lot of advertising.
Oh, hell yeah.
And their advertisements are creative. It's a really interesting company. The other thing that they've done, which is unique, is that they've found, you know, all these high-end designers that do this expensive stuff, and they've had them do a cheap line.
H&M started that, though, didn't they?
I don't know. I don't know the H&M story. I do know H&M is everywhere.
Yeah, H&M, I think they started with Karl Lagerfeld, who, of course, is massive designer, and he did a whole line at like $200 for whatever, a shirt or whatever, which is incredibly cheap for a Karl Lagerfeld. And there were people queued up in the morning just to get in. Anyway, Madonna did it. It wasn't successful, but they have a lot of big names doing
They do, like, you know, a guy who's a designer of you know, one thing or another. They have him do a toaster. I mean, they got, like, designed toasters and clocks and stuff like that. But I was, by the way, surprised. I was in Lisbon. There's an H&M there. I didn't know the place was. I didn't know it was an international chain.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. They're everywhere. But it started in the UK. No. Wait a minute. Yeah, Hammers and Morris.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. It's not American.
That's what it stands for?
Hammers and Morris, I think so, yeah.
Hmm.
Why?
Well, the reason is because it's one of those things that kind of snuck up on me. I was unaware of H&M until a couple years ago, and it was already it's already taken over the kids market. I mean, the kids, when I say kids, I mean, you know, college kids and high school kids and anyone under 25, that's where they shop.
Yeah.
And because, you know, and you go in there and you can see that they're oriented toward that age group. It's like 18 to 26, whatever the demo is. And they have a lot of nice, stylish stuff, you know, that's cheap. It's really cheap.
The big thing here is Primart. And Primart is, I'm sure it's made in Asian sweatshops, because the prices are just, it's so incredibly cheap. It's, it's the price of Kmart. But it's actually, you know, it's quick knockoffs, you know, so they look at whatever's in Vogue magazine or whatever is in Glamour or Marie Claire or whatever, and then they whip them up, which of course I'm sure comes directly from the back door of the the factories that are making the H&M stuff.
Yeah,
and say like boom, 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 and they hammer out. It's the same colors, it's the same patterns. It's just, there's no lawsuits in fashion.
No, you can't
for a number
copyright
of reasons.
A design.
You can't. Yeah, you can't.
So you can't copyright a font. So
is that true? You can't copyright a font. I didn't know that.
No, you can. No, that's why fonts are stolen. But what you can copyright is the name of the font.
Ah, okay.
So if you have you design a font like Hattenschweiler or one of these crazy things, or Universe, which is a UNI, or Helvetica is a classic example.
Helvetica
is the most the most used font in the world. And if you run into the knockoffs of it. Because it's owned by one of the foundries. All the knockoffs have different names. There's like Hell. My favorite one was Helves, H-E-L-V-S, which HP used on one of their cartridges early on. Yeah. Yeah, but there's otherwise they have all these.
But that's
other
not
names.
A copyright of the name. It's a trademark of the name.
Trademark, right? It's a trademark.
Okay.
And so you can't steal the. You can steal the font, the design of Helvetica, but you can't call it Helvetica, and that's what everybody does.
Funny.
But anyway, fashion is, by the way, and this is like an argument that the anti-patent people have and the anti-copyright people have, is that say, look, the fashion industry, if you design some fancy dress and you roll it out for $25,000, a couture, and then somebody else knocks it off and sells it for $150, exact same look and feel, you can't do anything about it. This is an argument against patents and copyrights because if you look at the picture overall, it's a highly competitive business and people in the fashion industry, many of them, make millions of dollars. It's a very successful industry with this model of everything being stolen constantly.
But it's not just stolen. It is a part of the entire infrastructure. Because if there were only designers making $25,000 outfits for a very small select clientele, we'd all be wearing potato sacks. And, of course, we'd be wearing very stupid, ugly clothing. So it trickles down, and it's meant to do that. And it's a whole power structure. And Elsa Clench from CNN and, these women and they are predominantly women, at least who are on the media side of fashion. They really control what we will look like, in 3 months from now or what we'll be wearing. And they love that. It's a part of how it all works.
What's funny, it even goes deeper than that. People don't realize is when they have, there are, it's done so far in advance. It reminds me a lot of the semiconductor business where you have a really long ramp because everybody knows we're going to go to 32 nanometers. We're going to do this. And it's always done in advance because you have this pacing that's set by Moore's law. And with fashion, all these this is the fall, this is fall colors. This is the new colors. We're going to have this orange and this blue that's got this tint and that. Those colors are done by these guys who do design inks and dyes 6 months earlier.
It's their specialty. Yeah, that's what they're doing.
And they come up with these colors way in advance of the fashion season because those dyes have to go into the cloth and they have to do all. So there's like a real long ramp, and then all of a sudden these new colors come out and everyone's all jacked up about them. Oh, that's the new green. You're wearing the old green.
Yep.
Well, you could have probably figured out what the new green's going to be if you were in the business because the things was decided like 9 months earlier or a year.
No, I think it's like six. It's like 6 months.
Okay,
it's still a long time.
Yeah, 6 months. Well, the problem is you have to come up with the fabric that uses the colors, and so there's a gap there because you got to manufacture the fabric.
Usually, the designers they step into that part of the process. So Karl Lagerfeld. He'll get fabric which already has there's a selection of colors that go with it, so they're even a step behind that.
Yeah, probably. I would think so. You'd have to be.
I happen to know so. I have a wife who was involved in all this.
Well, you have to anyway. So the ramp is large. It's long. It's not like it's a big shock that all of a sudden. I always get the biggest kick out of you go to Europe. Where they're more fashion-oriented, especially with these colors, than they are in the United States. And so you'll go past the department store, and they'll have all these colors, these new colors for this, season, this, spring, 2009. And so you see all these colors, and then And it was just, they really emphasized these colors in Europe. And you come to the U.S., and every so often there was a, I remember this one, there was this crazy rust color from some years ago that was just kind of almost gaudy. It was, they were pushing the heck out of it in Europe, and you could not even find this color in the United States. So apparently all our people said, screw it, we don't like this color. I don't care what anybody thinks. And we never got the color. It was just the funniest thing to see missing. I don't know.
I got two more things, unless you got something.
No, I got nothing. You can tell.
No, I like it, because you've been on a couple of good rants today.
Yeah, well, you know, it's early.
Do you know who Buckminster Fuller is?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody knows who Bucky is.
Well, I'm just learning about Bucky. Can you give me some background on this guy? He seems highly interesting.
He's very interesting. I think I've always thought he was very popular amongst the new age nutballs.
Yeah, yeah, that's why I like him. Exactly.
Well, if you were actually a new age nutball, which you're not, I can assure the audience, you would have known about him by now. The fact that you're so far behind on Buckminster Fuller proves and with authority that you're not a new age nutball. But I digress. So Buckminster Fuller had all these crazy ideas. He invented the geodesic dome.
Right.
He did experiments on himself. He did this crazy experiment about sleeping. He put himself in some isolation and decided to sleep when he felt like, and found that you only needed, if you didn't have any beds or anywhere to sleep, and you just conk out when you felt like, and then wake up and conk out and wake up. Kind of the pass out theory of,
hey, that's kind of how I live my life.
He says it turns out you only need 4 hours a day. And,
I need a little more than that.
And he also did a thing called the Dymaxion car, which is the one you should really look into, because that's the funniest thing. But when you look at like his Dymaxion car and all his other theories and things, I always thought he was like a crackpot. He came up with a couple of interesting ideas, but when you start seeing how these things, in terms of aesthetics, the Dymaxion car was the ugliest, stupidest thing ever put on the road.
What was so special about it? What was the advantage?
It had it steered from the one wheel in the back or something. It was made out of the kind of material that airplanes are made out of.
Carbon fiber?
No, we're talking about back in the 30s, aluminum.
Aluminium, yes.
Aluminium. And it was just the dumbest thing, and it apparently killed somebody in New York in a freak accident, and then they stopped making them, it's weird.
Let me give you the context of how I've come in contact with the work of Buckminster Fuller, and I'm really interested in how he makes money, what his deal is.
Is he dead?
Well, there you go.
He's been dead for years, as far as I know.
Oh, maybe I should retract that email with the interview request. That's such a good idea.
Look him up on Wikipedia.
Well, there's this piece of video where he's talking about 2012, which of course I'm interested in.
Oh God, yeah.
And he says this is humanity's final exam. And what was interesting, the concepts we have to understand. He said you are not actually of this era if you cannot grasp the following two concepts.
He died in 83, by the way.
Okay, so he was an early kook. So one, the concept that the sun does not set. Unless you can actually envision yourself spinning on the globe at 24,000 miles an hour and spinning past the sun, then you're still living in 500 years in the past. And he says the second one, and this is funny, and I'm going to start using this just to piss people off. There is no up or down. There is out, in, and around, or through. But there's no up and down. Because you actually, when you go up in an airplane, you're actually going out of the earth. And if you're going towards the moon, you're going into the moon. And it was a concept. I was like, wow, that's pretty interesting. And then when you start thinking about it, and when you start feeling yourself being on the globe, which is spinning around, I don't know. It had an elevating effect on me, I guess.
Yeah, well, apparently it did. I find the whole thing to be specious, tedious, and bullshit. Spaceship Earth was one of the things that he, named, and everybody got jacked up about that. I mean, yeah, he was
Spaceship Earth. I got to write this down. Is that a book? What is that?
He popularized the term. This is Wikipedia. I remember Spaceship Earth. Oh yeah, okay, whatever. Anyway, the geodesic domes is the main thing. And people would build these domes because they're actually very good. It's a good, very strong structure, but they're the gosh awful lookingest thing. They're horrible. You know, aesthetically, yeah. To see these domes that people
it's
would
like
build.
It's like you're living in Epcot.
Worse.
Because like
they had this structure of it. The thing was just ugly. It looked like it's just creepy looking. And so, but people would build them because, oh, it's a geodesic dome, Buckminster Fuller. Anyway, so you can tell I'm not a particular
fan.
Not really. I mean, I don't see what his contribution really was. I don't know.
Well, that's why I asked.
Well, now you know. But go to the Dymaxion is the stuff you want to look into, because that's the funniest stuff.
Dymaxion car. Okay. Is it with an X, Dymaxion?
Yeah, it's Dymaxion.
Okay.
Dymaxion.
Oh, I'll definitely look into that. And then before we leave, I'll just crank up the printing press one more time. Interesting story in the Financial Times that... for the first time, and this is always kind of important when you look at economics in the United States. I have a great picture of Rahm Emanuel here, by the way, looking really scary.
Scary guy.
For the first time, the London School of Economics is almost in the majority in Obama's cabinet/buddies. Because normally, this is a big deal, right? It's like, what school? You know, of course, Bill Clinton was Oxford.
So what was read that again?
I'll read you the headline, actually. London School of Economics is well represented amongst Obama's buddies. And, the point of it is that, and I'm looking for the names here. Peter Orszag as budget director, Pete Rouse and Mona Sutphen as senior White House staff means the London School of Economics only has two fewer graduates than Harvard in Team Obama. And it goes on to list, you know, only one from MIT. And it seems like in the UK, of course, all the politicians come from, what's that horrible boys' school named?
Exeter.
No, it's in Exeter, probably. No, it's not. Is it Exeter?
I think so.
No, it's something else. But anyway, I just thought it was interesting.
Tell us. We'll find out. I thought it was Exeter. But anyway, I was looking at this, and everybody's got a PhD. It's like they all went to, like, Yale, and then they've got at Harvard. But mostly Harvard is the different. I mean, what we had, you know, we had during the Bush administration, everybody's a Yalie. And then, all everyone's from Yale. You have to be from Yale. And then this is switching over to Harvard, which I actually think is an improvement. But I could be wrong. And because who knows? I mean, I don't understand why we don't have more West Coast representation. There's nobody from, you know, Berkeley, you know, or any of these schools out here. You don't have too much Caltech, you know, represented in the government. So all these East Coast Ivy League clubby schools that, you know, have the same fraternities, and it makes you wonder.
Yeah, like skull and bone shit.
Yeah.
Eton is the one in the UK.
Oh, Eton. That's it. Eton. I'm sorry. Eton. Yeah. I knew that.
I knew it too.
So, oops.
Well, anyway, for those of you who that is the final thing I wanted to say. Those of you who are enjoying the change, which is already taking place, we can see it perfectly. The guy in the front has changed. Everyone else in the back remains the same in the administration. Twice now I've noticed on both the Jon Stewart show, the Daily Show, and on I saw it happen on the Tonight Show with Jay Leno. He had, I forget her name. She has a talk show on E! She's like a comedian. Kind of funny, tall, milfy-looking chick. Yeah, you don't know.
No, I don't know.
But, you know, when people pull out an obvious crowd-pleaser, you know, like the old, hey, but we got change, Obama's in, and the audience goes dead silent. There's no more cheering, there's no more laughter, there's no more, yeah, we got him, look at you, you know, we're rocking and rolling, the country is back. It's not even a chuckle, John.
Really?
Completely, it's dying. You cannot use Obama as a crowd pleaser anymore on these talk shows.
That's interesting.
Now, I thought that was highly interesting because that shows a real change in mentality almost overnight.
It doesn't take much. The American public in particular is extremely fickle, and they can turn on a dime. I mean, that's what, in fact, I've seen the economy do these crazy turn on a dime things. I mean, we had, I'm still stunned by this. You know, I was, like I said, I was just in Portugal and the prices were reasonable compared to, you know, not, we haven't gotten.
Well, with your American dollar now, which is being artificially inflated.
But that's what I'm
going
to say is,
yeah.
Like, you know, we had, you know, the pound got to $2 and the weird thing was that the Canadian dollar got to a dollar, became 1-to-1. And when this thing turned around just like a month or two ago, which I expected, it took years to get where it got, and it turns around and goes right back to 76 cents or 75 cents for the Canadian dollar. Yep. And the pound is back, was $1.46 when I went there, which was low. It was usually $1.55, you know, and traditionally. So it was $1.46, which was low. Once it goes below $1.50, to me, that's like bargain time in England. I'm thinking, this just happened overnight. I've never seen anything, a collapse like this. I mean, yeah. The gas prices, I bought gasoline for $1.99 premium.
And the same thing, so it's the euro, same thing, crushed, the pound, super crushed. It was $2. Now it's $1.53. That's an unbelievable drop.
Yeah, in such a short time.
I figured it out. It's the other way around. It's an unbelievable rise in the dollar because the Federal Reserve is selling gold. They're selling it like no one else's business. You know who's buying it? You know who's buying the gold?
You are.
Yeah. Some of it. No, Iran actually just purchased $75 billion worth of gold. You know, this is not just a bunch of camel jockeys out there. They know what they're doing. And I think they're incredibly smart.
Oh, that means that gold is going to collapse. We only do stuff like this to screw people.
Hey, John, welcome to the dark side.
I'm telling you. I got nothing against it. If you want to sell the gold to a bunch of dumb Iranians and then pull the rug out from under them, I don't have a problem with it. It doesn't,
well,
you know, got nothing
to
do with me.
Lindsay Williams, the chaplain, who I completely base all of my predictions on just by parroting him, who worked for the oil companies in Alaska. This is the guy who said it's going to go to 200 and that it's going to happen now, and he was right. And
what's going to go to 200?
Oil.
It never went to 200.
It went close, but then he came out
close,
and said,
it got to 147.
Close enough. It was 60 when he said it. You know, not even. It was 50 when he said it. He came out a couple months ago, or 6 or 8 weeks ago, and he said, it's going down to 50. And of course, it's gone down to 50. And he says it's staying there a long time. And the reason why he claims that he actually speaks to one of these guys who determines this, he says because they want to bankrupt the Middle East. They want to completely bankrupt them. They're going to keep the oil at $50. They want them out of the way.
They should drop it to 40. I mean, it's traditionally 25.
I think it's become too expensive right now, just to get it out of the ground costs $30 or $40.
Well, you know, you can bankrupt these guys if you get everybody, you know, on the same page that's going to go to 200, and everybody starts banking on it, and they start all these green projects, and we're going to do solar, and we're going to do all those other things, because, you know, the cost of oil makes it profitable to do all these other alternative energy tricks, usually over, you know, anytime it goes over 40, actually. And then you get everybody all geared up for this stuff, and you have the, you know, Goldman Sachs come out and say it's going to go to 200. They're amongst the group that was cheerleading. And then the thing, you know, everybody's all geared up for this $200 deal, you know, and it's already at 140.
It was a setup.
It's a setup, and you're in. You push all your chips to the middle of the table, and then, boom, you pull the rug out from under, and this thing falls like a rock. If you take a look at the charts, by the way, I mean, this oil price thing went straight down. It wasn't like, well, let me hesitate here and just loop down. It wasn't like it was going over a cliff in a nice, smooth curve. It went straight down with one blip, but it went basically straight down.
I love it how politicians still talk about the incredible price of oil.
No, they don't even notice.
They keep saying that. Oil is so expensive. Energy costs are very expensive. Blah, blah, blah.
I know. Don't they go outside?
Although it is true that Shell, I just read this today, Shell had to shut down their Nigerian liquid natural gas production, which is where Europe gets almost all of their energy from the Nigerian liquid natural gas. So I predict that when it comes to heating, you know, like gas heating, etc., I think it's going to skyrocket. At least in Europe, it's going to go out of control. And then, of course, we have to go buy it from the Russians, which is going to be interesting.
Well, I know Shell had that advertisement. They actually had a channel on the Dish Network promoting this liquid natural gas bullshit.
It's so evil. That's the Dutch royal family, the House of Orange, founders of the Bilderberg Group.
Well,
yep. Let's end it on a high, John.
The high is you can buy premium gas now for around $2.
Yeah, I'll take it. That's good. And now I can fly much cheaper too.
I would
but,
think.
I don't know. Yeah, the weather is completely crap. Absolutely no flying.
Mm.
All right. What's coming up this week? Anything special besides Cyber Monday?
What's going on Cyber Monday?
Cyber Monday. It's the internet's version of Black Friday.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm going to be plugging all of our deals, all of our get them cheap deals. See if we can hop on the bandwagon.
Hmm.
Get a cheap deal on budget.
I got a bunch of budget.com/tech. The I have to. There's something I had to do. Yeah, I got to order some
stuff. T E C H, right? Budget.com/TECH.
Yeah, T E C H. Yeah,
go to 10% off. It's mevioffers.com is where you can find all of it.
You can.
But hook,
you
know, hook John up. Hook John up.
I need some, you know, some action.
Yeah,
so, I got to go do my online ordering because I think, you know, next week is probably the best, you know, after that, you're never going to get
Monday. That's what Cyber Monday is all about. That's the day when you get all the best deals. Now, it'll really be dependent upon what happens today on Black Friday. I mean,
what do you think is going to happen? Just predict it.
Okay. Well, I have to say, I've already watched some of the news, and it seemed like this is what they were reporting on CNBC. On the West Coast, because they had reporters in the malls. Right? This is how crazy we are. On the West Coast, it seemed like same amount of people were showing up, but now they have to find out how the sales figures are. But on the West Coast, people were using predominantly cash. On the East Coast, people using 85% using credit cards.
We're always ahead of the game out here.
So I'm going to predict we will see a, not a significant drop. I'm going to say 20 to 25% less than last year, which of course will be amazing because it'll be the first time in 100 years that we've actually gone down in, Black Friday sales. But I think it's going to be 20 to 25% down.
I'm saying 5% down.
Okay. 5. All right. Interesting. And we'll find out tomorrow, but we won't talk about it until next week. All right, everybody, coming to you from Gitmo East in the United Kingdom, I'm Adam Curry.
And Gitmo West, I'm in northern Silicon Valley, I'm John C. Dvorak.
We'll talk to you again next week right here on No Agenda.